this week on the Best of Flashpoints.
5 years after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, Dennis Bernstein continues his five-year conversation with Malik Rahim of Common Ground. We speak with a Mississippi Gulf activist sent to jail for speaking her mind to her governor regarding his phony cleanup plan. And we get an update on the struggle to save Wesley United Church, a cornerstone of the African-American community in New Orleans. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and now up front with Eric Klein.
A local Seattle story of police brutality sparked national interest this spring, only after there was an interesting media angle. Freelance videographer Judd Morris shot news footage of two men lying on the sidewalk as half a dozen Seattle police officers stood over them. The footage clearly shows one of the officers leaning in close to the head of the man on the ground and yelling, "I'm going to beat the effing Mexican piss out of you, homie. You feel me?" And then casually delivering a swift kick to the top of the man's head. Another officer steps over, with arms crossed, and stomps once on the man's leg. When videographer Morris delivered this tape to his newsroom, local Fox affiliate Q13 in Seattle, they declined the opportunity to air it, saying reportedly that it was not egregious. The story drew national attention only after the videographer posted the rejected footage to YouTube, where it was picked up by a competing station in Seattle and aired as breaking news. Q13 responded by firing their freelancer and suing their competitor for airing the very same footage that they had earlier rejected. Janine Jackson is FAIR's program director and the producer and co-host of the syndicated radio program Counterspin. She recently published a commentary on Common Dreams in which she notes that the national media attention to the story was drawn to the local media controversy and missed something far more important.
What didn't get talked about was what was on the tape. What does it mean, and this was a gang unit, what does it mean that you have a gang unit policing Seattle whose officers are really comfortably and easily express this kind of violent racism? Surely this has other impacts on their policing. Is it okay for cops to threaten to beat the piss out of someone? You know, the tape was talked about, but the reality of it was not discussed. It was really media doing a thing they do a lot, where they talk about themselves, and then they think that passes for actual exploration.
Jackson believes the story points out that some television news departments have troubling ties to local law enforcement.
One of the things that happened behind the scenes that was very interesting was that Judd Morris, the videographer, says that when he brought the tape in, one of the news staffers actually got on the phone to the cops while she was watching the tape. So she was essentially kind of vetting the story with police before any news judgment had been made. And he thought that was kind of odd, to be checking with the police to determine whether or not you're even going to air something like this. It really suggested a kind of closeness with law enforcement that he thought, and I would agree with him, came to interfere with their reporting.
Janine Jackson of FAIR. This week marked 5 years since Hurricane Katrina struck America's Gulf Coast region, causing an estimated 1 million people to flee their communities, the largest number of internally displaced people in modern U.S. history. Monique Hardin is co-founder and attorney with New Orleans-based Advocates for Environmental Human Rights, online at ehumanrights.org. Hardin says that New Orleans residents learned a strange lesson in the wake of the disaster, that under a little-known U.S. law, citizens may not be as protected as they believe.
When the president declares a national disaster, it triggers a federal law called the Robert T. Stafford Disaster Relief and Emergency Assistance Act, or Stafford Act for short. What most people don't know, but we certainly have learned since the hurricane, is that the law has two really problematic provisions. The first is that it leaves all decisions to act or not to act at the discretion of whoever is in the White House. And so, you know, if remembering the images across TV screens of people crying out for help, on rooftops, people who had died and were floating in floodwaters. As inhumane and nightmarish and ghastly as that was, it was never illegal under this law. The second troubling provision is that it actually denies an individual, a person who is affected by a national disaster, the right to claim assistance for anything, including, according to the law, the reduction of life-threatening risks, emergency medical care, food, shelter, etc. Basic, you know, necessities that we need to survive are denied as a right under this law.
Monique Hardin says that there's been some progress building awareness in the public, as well as key congressional members, with the shortcomings of the country's disaster policies.
We've had discretionary decisions allowed under the Stafford Act during the previous administration that have actually prolonged our displacement in a number of ways by destroying housing, privatizing schools, firing teachers, abandoning and closing public hospitals. It's been a huge problem. One of the other things that's part of this advocacy among people in the Gulf region is fighting for a federal law that's currently pending in Congress called the Gulf Coast Civics Works Act. And the idea of the legislation is sort of like a Marshall Plan for the Gulf region, where there are a number of projects for restoring communities that employ the people from those communities in that work, as well as create incentives for sustainable rebuilding so that we're ensuring resiliency from future storms that come our way.
Monique Hardin of Advocates for Environmental Human Rights says that there's been racial discrimination in federal recovery programs post-Katrina.
Just a few weeks ago, there was a federal court decision declaring that the program that was set up in the state of Louisiana was racially discriminatory and created a situation where African Americans received less money for their homes than white residents who were applicants into this home assistance program. We've got a situation that also compromises predominantly African American neighborhoods in the way the Army Corps of Engineers went about flood wall and levee repairs and upgrades. Some $14 billion was allocated by Congress for the Corps to do this in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And the outcome is that predominantly African-American neighborhoods in the New Orleans area have very inadequate flood protection, according to the Army Corps of Engineers on reports. So, for example, the neighborhood of Gentilly would have, according to the Corps, 6 inches of less flood water than was the case with Hurricane Katrina, where there was like, you know, 6-7 feet of water in this neighborhood. Whereas predominantly white neighborhoods in the New Orleans area, like Old Metairie and Lakeview, would have 5.5 feet less flood water, which would create a situation where, according to the Corps, if a storm like Katrina came through again and those neighborhoods flooded the way they did during Hurricane Katrina, it would just really be a mop job that those residents would have. Whereas for African-American residents living in predominantly African-American neighborhoods, it would be a total nightmare.
Again, Monique Hardin of Advocates for Environmental Human Rights, online at ehumanrights.org. I'm Eric Klein for Flashpoints Up Front.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Read that last story as black people drown. Joining us to talk about those neighborhoods and an old friend of this broadcast is Malik Rahim. I want to tell people that you are the founder of Common Ground in the Lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans. And Malik, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Oh, thank you, Dennis. It's an honor to be on your show.
Well, it's an honor to have you back. And clearly, it doesn't really seem to matter which president is president when it comes to the needs of poor people and the working people of New Orleans or across this country. What we got is Blackwater armed to shoot to kill. Let's talk a little Rorschach. When you hear the word we have to do better at dealing with a natural disaster. How do you feel about that word, natural disaster?
Well, you know, natural disasters are things that we're going to always have to deal with, you know, regardless of what part of the nation we live in. You know, in California, one of the most dangerous things is the earthquake. Here, you know, it's a hurricane. We have been blessed because we get 3 to 4 days notice to prepare for this upcoming disaster. So disasters is something that we all going to have to deal with. But the thing that we don't have to deal with is the transformation of a disaster into a tragedy. And that's what Katrina became, a tragedy.
Talk about the tragedy 5 years after, Malik. Talk about what goes on in the Lower Ninth Ward and that racism that was alluded to. And it really is about class as well, of course.
Well, first, I just want to correct you on one thing, Dennis. We are not an organization that is just centered in the Ninth Ward. And atrocities that was carried out in the aftermath of Katrina, it wasn't just directed to the Ninth Ward. It happened in Algiers. It happened uptown. It happened downtown. It happened throughout the greater New Orleans area. So, again, we have to always remember that we are in the Deep South. And everything in the South is perpetuated by race and then class. And we're talking about those who our city officials that deem to be no longer necessary. You know, individuals that was no longer accepted or tolerated. So, so Katrina transformed the everyday racism into a 4 days of pure hell, or 4 days that I classified as fascism.
And you are not talking about metaphors. Your community faced an onslaught.
When, now it's finally being exposed because for the last 4.5 years, I've been basically classified as someone who was basically unbalanced, somebody who was old militant that was trying to perpetuate events that or make allegations that was unfounded or untrue, that there was no killings, that there was no vigilantes, that all this was a figment of my imagination. But now it's starting to come out to be true, exactly what's transpired. You know, how the police, and just a couple of days ago, in the article dated Wednesday, August the 25th, the headlines is that an order was given by then Deputy Superintendent Warren Wiley to shoot all looters. You know, so when you're talking about just basically killing people for trying to survive, when you're not providing them anything, then you're no longer talking about racism. You're talking about fascism. And this was an African-American, a so-called African-American that was given this order, to slaughter other African-Americans. So, again, under administration that was led by a so-called African-American mayor. So, again, you're talking about some of the worst events that ever happened in American history that happened here in aftermath of Katrina. And most people do not understand exactly what transpired. What type of impact it left upon our entire community? That for 4 years we had to watch vigilantes that killed at will. You know, I mean, you have one who was deported, not for the statement I'm about to give, only because he had gotten into a fight with his brother-in-law. You know, but this guy state to the police that they killed 38 people. You know, and that they gave the bodies to the Coast Guard. This was brought out. This is a statement that he made. Everybody say, oh, well, he's lying. But this is a statement that he made to the police. And it took 4 years. But see, another thing I just want to say, it took the transformation of presidents. Because I know if McCain would have been elected president, that these atrocities that happened in New Orleans would never have been exposed. But it would took a person like who Obama had appointed as the Attorney General to make known what is going on, what has happened here. But the thing that I always will take out of this, that it wasn't just these little 16 rogue police that they are saying, because this order wasn't given to just the 16. this order was given throughout the city for police to shoot all looters. And one thing about when you're talking about a police or those that are in the business or in the profession of security, that they investigate. So it's impossible for these atrocities to happen in a city the size of New Orleans without the FBI knowing that it's happening and all of Homeland Security.
Now, let me jump in there, Malik, because this is very important. Now, people who listen to this broadcast right after Katrina heard you and heard you talking about the amount of bodies that were showing up and where they were putting the bodies and the shoot to kill at the bridge. And you're making the point that it wasn't just a particularly corrupt police department, which the police of New Orleans are, but this was at the state level, at the federal level. And the thing that you and I both know, because we experienced it, Malik, is that the FBI was obviously involved, because not only did they know what was going on, but they took time to infiltrate both Pacifica and Common Ground. And we now know that the FBI had informants inside your organization, right?
Did we have one? Listen, one of the founding members was an FBI, not informer, but provocateur. Informer is one that just spies to get information. But he was more than an informer. He was a provocateur. He was sent in to dismantle Common Ground, to destroy everything that we were doing. You have many individuals that left from Common Ground in disgust because of Brandon Darby. So again, you know, he was...
And Brandon Darby self-proclaimed. He went public. He proudly proclaimed his work against you and other grassroots activists.
Oh, yes, but see, he didn't just do it against us. He did it against America. He did it against everything that this nation is supposed to stand for. I mean, what type of person in the aftermath of a disaster infiltrate an organization that is the only organization that at that time providing any type of service? Because you got to remember, the first health clinic to open in the aftermath of Katrina was opened because of Common Ground. The first distribution centers that was set up in from Homer to the lower Ninth Ward was set up by Common Ground. Right now, we have served over 500,000 people in spite of a Brandon Darby. So, I mean, but when you look at what did he destroy? How he destroyed and dismantled our environmental program, our health to serve program, how he ran off environmental scientists, how he orchestrated the takeover of our health clinic, the housing program that we had set up, you know, and at night, what the relationship we had with the Catholic Church. So again, he was more than just an informer. He was probably the worst type of provocateur. But again, what type of society will allow this to happen? What do we say about America when our government, after knowing that we was a nonviolent organization, kept this person in to create these dastardly deeds? What type of government existed? And then how can it just be swept under the rug? You know, I mean, everything that was said about yesterday's events, all this, but no one talks about this. Common Ground was never mentioned. Again, and we have helped over 500,000 people, but it was never mentioned. We have opened up health clinics. We have opened up legal clinics. You know, I mean, Brad Pitt is in the Ninth Ward, but he wouldn't have been there if it wouldn't have been for Common Ground. You know, I mean, the city of New Orleans recovered because of Common Ground. Because in the aftermath of Katrina and prior to Hurricane Rita, it was Common Ground volunteers that got out in Algiers and cleaned almost 80% of the storm drain. So that when that hurricane happened, Hurricane Rita, it did not flood Algiers. And Algiers was the launching board for the recovery of the city. So again, Common Ground was there, but it never was mentioned. Why? Because of the stance that we have made. Because of the fact that we had volunteers that came into the Deep South, white, predominantly white volunteers, working under the leadership of an African American, and doing this in spite of every governmental attempt to destroy them or to dismantle them. You know, I mean, many of our early volunteers was beaten, you know, was arrested, and many were threatened simply for standing up for justice. You know, I mean, this whole exposure of these police wouldn't have happened if it wouldn't have been for our volunteers. A.C. Thompson came down here because of common ground. You know, that's the reason why he was able to expose this. So, I mean, so we was right there. But again, you know, it is nothing that is being said about it. Yesterday, events was held all throughout the city, and Common Ground wasn't invited to none.
Well, if you call information and you ask for Common Ground these days, you get a legal clinic. You get, no, because I was looking for my friend Malik Rahim, so I called one number, I got the legal clinic. I called another number, I got the medical clinic. I called another number, I got a message in terms of if you're just coming back to try and rebuild your house and if you need a certain kind of help. I got another number from Common Ground, and then I got another and another and another. That is our brother, that is friend, our friend who we're talking to, we've been talking to for 5 years about this work, Malik Rahim. And I became very suspicious of that bastard, that infiltrator, when he kept starting to call me and he said, you know, I want to get involved in helping the Palestinians. Can you imagine? And I'm thinking, really? You want to help the Palestinians, but you've been busy there with my friend Malik Rahim in New Orleans. What does this have to do with the Palestinians? And there was some crap about, oh, we're all one together.
Well, Dennis, listen, in the house, right after Katrina, I met with the ambassador of Venezuela. Cuba has the best evacuation plan for the evacuation of those that's in danger of a hurricane, then Venezuela have probably the second best. I sent Brandon over to Venezuela to find out some of the techniques that they use. Because
the infiltrator, yes, go on.
No, the provocateur.
Yes.
He went over there and destroyed that. He tried to use that visit to infiltrate the so-called guerrilla movement in Venezuela. He literally destroyed it. When he came back, it's funny that you mentioned about Palestine, because that was the next thing he wanted me to send him to send him over to Palestine, because that's where he wanted to go, because he wanted to show a common ground on an international level. But by the grace of the Most High, I refuse to even deal with him on that type of level. You know, I mean, Dennis, this man, and when you look at anything that's happened internationally, then you're not just talking about an FBI informant. You're talking about a CIA informant, a provocateur, because that's what happens on an international level. So again, you have that. And you could always see that arm in what happened in the aftermath of Katrina by looking at what Blackwater came in here to do. You know, I mean, why was Blackwater given $70 million to come into New Orleans in the aftermath of Katrina? What did they do to earn that $70 million? How come when you investigate those little police, why is there no one investigating what did Blackwater do while they was here? You know, did they use any weapons? And why was they here? You know, what was they here for? You know, I mean, the intimidation factor of what they have left there literally traumatized this entire community, which is one of the reasons why we have such a high murder rate now. Because everybody here basically believes no one cares. No one cares what happened to the poor, because that's what happened to them. They tore down every public housing, major public housing development in the city of New Orleans in the aftermath of Katrina. And nobody cared. They rebuilt these houses, and the houses are beautiful, without offering any type of employment opportunity to existing residents from these areas. You know, so what you have now, you have brand new developments that was built for the poor, There will be nothing but housing for the poor because they didn't give no one the opportunity for social or economic upliftment. This is a sad situation. I would say high point in it is now it seems like we have an administration that cares. Because the last administration, I'm ashamed to say it, the last administration was one that only duped us into believing that they truly cared about what's going on. And it's a sad epithet that we even reelected Reagan.
Amazing. Forgive me, I'm getting a little angry myself here. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Malik Rahim. We began this dialogue over 5 years ago as Katrina hit, and we heard a voice who we knew from the Bay Area who was down on the front line in the Lower Ninth Ward, which was left. For many years, it was known that there was this tragedy waiting to happen. There's a lot of information, Malik, that the Army Corps of Engineers knew, the government knew that there was trouble here, that this kind of storm was going to be big trouble. And in fact, it could mean and could be used and was used for a ethnic cleansing, an attempted ethnic cleansing of the African community. How do you respond to that? Do you see this as a purposeful attempt to cleanse the community?
Well, that's what it was. It's not that if I see it, anyone can see it. Look at those who are still displaced. You know, 90% of them are African American. You know, so again, yeah, it was a means of it. Where again, when I talked about these major public housing, that was basically housing for poor African Americans that was no longer tolerated. I sit on the board of Community Service Center, which is the oldest ex-offenders program in the city, in the state of Louisiana, and one of the oldest in the South. It was established in 1965. In the aftermath of Katrina, we was only given $25,000 by the United Way. With all the money that it raised, that organization that have a history of helping thousands upon thousands of ex-offenders upon their release, they was only given $25,000. Why? Because they said it wasn't going to be any need for it because everybody was displaced. So again, yeah, it was a part of that ethnic cleansing. And that's why I say that this was, because it went beyond just racism. This was fascism. This was a means of destroying and displacing a whole segment of our population based upon race. You know, I mean, no one is, Gretna was forgotten. How it was able to close its borders to African Americans, you know, simply because of the fact of the color of their skin. Because I tell you what, if it would have been white New Orleans that was fleeing and going to Gretna, they would have been allowed then. But nobody is saying that. Nobody is talking about this. And you can't just sweep it under the rug because it can happen again. Just think if a major earthquake would happen in California. How far would it break down before it starts be talking about race? How far would it be where they're talking about because our government isn't prepared for something that it wasn't prepared for events that only affected hundreds of thousands of people? So what would it do if it's talking about an event that's now affecting tens of millions of people? What's going to happen before they get their act together? That's why it's important for progressive people, I don't care where you are, to start organizing and making preparations in case of these events. Because a disaster can happen anywhere. And we must always be there to be the conscience of this nation. Because without the progressive movement, without them understanding the plight that we are in, it's easy for this country to degrade back into an era of racism based upon race, based upon class, to the degree that life and death situations is being rendered.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Malik Rahim. He is the founder of Common Ground. We thank you, Malik. Please be careful. Nobody's going to get in the way of us talking, right? Nobody.
Oh, no. Dennis, listen, let me tell you something. I believe that there's no greater thing that a person can do than standing up for justice. And I know that because of organizations and individuals like you, it make us down here that's constantly under fire, make us know that we have support. Because, again, you know, the mainstream media gave no regard to what I've told you.
All right. Well, we care and we take it deep. We'll talk to you soon, Malik. Be careful again, please.
All right. And thank you again, Dennis.
Our pleasure, our honor. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short musical break, give everybody a slight breather, and then we're going to come back with somebody who's also made a real commitment to try and hold Mississippi, the government, those people responsible for the cleanup of the BP disaster accountable. Stay with us. We are joined again from Mississippi by Linda St. Martin. She's had a very eventful last couple of days. She is the head of the first responders trying to deal with the BP disaster. It's not over. It's really not over down there. And Linda knows firsthand how touchy people can get when you raise issues. Linda St. Martin, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Good evening, Dennis. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you, for the first time ever in your life, were arrested. You want to tell us what happened?
Dennis, on Saturday, we were having a meeting with members of the EPA, the Department of Marine Resources, the Coast Guard, and of course, British Petroleum. We were at a Ocean Springs, Mississippi Cultural Center, and they were telling us how safe the seafood was. All these government officials trying to tell us it's safe to eat the seafood and encouraging the shrimpers to go out to fish. Well, there aren't any shrimp out there to be caught after BP's finished with them. And then the other thing they're wanting the shrimpers and fishermen to do right now is to sign waivers that certifies that the seafood that they catch out in the Gulf and bring to the processing plant is safe, and that they will be liable if anybody gets sick or if there are any toxins in the seafood. The shrimpers don't have anything to do with that. The dispersants and oil have killed a lot of the fish. And you know, what is the deal? The government is the one that's saying they're safe to eat. The government and the British Petroleum are saying, go out there and shrimp. Go out there and fish. And they're not willing to take any of the responsibility. Well, we were sitting there in the audience, and a number of people, they're tightening down on us, Dennis. It's getting worse and worse. At our meetings now, there are lots of armed guards who watch us, the people, the shrimpers, the fishermen, the oystermen. The armed guards look at us and surveil us. British Petroleum killed 11 people, but the people with the guns are surveilling us, and there's getting to be more and more of them at all our meetings. And British Petroleum and the government officials are ratcheting it up a notch with the psychology and the pressure and the way they conduct meetings. They'll have a big panel. This particular one on Saturday had 10 people, and they'll set a very specific time for the meeting. They take a long time to introduce everybody on the panel, which eats into the meeting time. Consequently, it eats into the time that the public has to ask questions and make comments. Okay, that's one of their tactics. Then they have, after they introduce everybody with this long introduction, they have their little PowerPoint presentation. And guess what, Dennis? For the first time, they have told us we cannot just go to a microphone and ask questions. We have to write the questions down on a little card that they come around and pick up. This is a great disadvantage to a lot of the folks in the Vietnamese community. They don't write English. They've never had a Vietnamese person or interpreter. Well, very few meetings have had Vietnamese interpreters. The one on Friday did not, and the one on Saturday.
And there are major fishing communities there.
The Vietnamese folks are one-third of our fishing they're one-third of the fishing fleet for the commercial fishermen. One-third. And at our meetings when it's just the fishermen there, we always have interpreters. We get interpreters, we get the headsets, and we make it possible for everybody to participate. So there we were sitting there, and they were making us this time write the questions down. Which, of course, means they can then filter the questions and only answer the ones they want to. And people had made comments. In fact, one young woman, Angel Trong, had enough of it, and she stood up in the aisle and asked her questions. And she said, "I'm the daughter of a fisherman, and I think you need to hear from me." And, you know, we've lived through this oil spill, and you need to hear our voice. And she was asking questions about why the fishermen are being held responsible. Well, she stood up in the middle of the meeting and did that, in the middle of this meeting where we are supposed to be asking our questions on cards. Okay, well, you know, she had things to do that day. She had to leave, so she did, but they let her stand up in the middle of the floor in the aisle, the center aisle, and ask her question. But a little time passed, and then the fellow from the Bureau of Marine Resources said something, I can't even remember what it was exactly right now, about the safety of the seafood and why the shrimpers should accept the liability for catching toxic food, which they refused to do. He said something so ludicrous, I started to laugh. And a police officer from Ocean Springs, Officer Johnson, came over and told me I was making too much noise. And I had been observing how they were conducting this meeting, using every kind of intimidation tactic they could, with more guards, more police, more BMR officials with guns, watching us, staring us down, really trying to intimidate us. And Dennis, I pointed to his gun and I said, "Are there real bullets in that gun?" Whereupon another police officer from the city of Ocean Springs came over and said, "Ma'am, you are under arrest." And they took me out. They put handcuffs on me. They put me in a squad car and took me to the police station where they filled out a lot of paperwork and stuff like that. And I was charged with disturbing the peace, given my court date, which is October the 10th. And then I had to call somebody to come and get me. But the fishermen who were there with me, they were sitting all around me. Everybody was very stunned. But when I was taken out, one of the officers came and sat behind the fisherman. It came and sat in the chair where I was sitting and leaned forward and said to the fisherman who was sitting in front of the chair where I had been sitting, he said, "You're next." And to one of the other fishermen who was a leader in that group, one of the other officers came over and talked to him and said, "We're going to get you too." They are targeting the leaders. They targeted me because I pulled the people together. I pulled the fishermen together. I keep us unified. They are targeting our leaders and trying to intimidate us and trying to keep us, make us be quiet, which we never shall do, Dennis. We never shall do. We are not going to allow their intimidation tactics to work. We are citizens of the United States. British Petroleum, a foreign company, murdered 11 Americans. We are not going to let them call the shots while we sit back and say nothing. We are going to stand up. We are going to expose them. We are going to expose their bully tactics for what they are. Intimidation, an attempt at intimidation because they are not taking responsibility for the horrible crimes they have committed in the Gulf of Mexico.
Now, we have 60 seconds left, Linda, and it is incredibly powerful, the stand that you're taking. I asked you when you called me, I think, just when you were getting out or getting picked
up. Yes, I did.
Over the weekend, and we appreciate that communication. I asked you then, this is the first time you've ever been arrested. This is not something you take lightly, but apparently, can you take the final 30 seconds to again remind us what it is that's motivating you?
Dennis, this is my home. This is my home, and these are my people. If you cannot stand up for your home and your people, if you cannot fight for your home and your people when you are threatened with peril like this, then what will you stand up for?
And Linda, if people want to find out more about what the struggle is that the people of Mississippi and that the fishermen and that this Vietnamese community is facing, how can they very briefly get information? Where can they go?
Well, my email is zyx1010@aol.com. And if they will email me, I will put them in touch with a lot of resources.
All right. Linda?
By the way, I'm yes. out of interns. I need another intern, Dennis.
Maybe somebody Maybe somebody listening in this community wants an inspirational position working with Linda St. Martin. She's the head of first responders from Mississippi fighting against the all. Thanks, Linda. Keep us posted.
Rock the hot day face, sit right out of the hiding place to go. Sit rock the hot day face, sit rock out of the hiding place to go. Sit rock the hot day face, sit rock out of the hiding place. Oh Lord, oh Lord,
hey my boy.
We take it back to New Orleans. We continue our coverage of New Orleans 5 years after Katrina. There's a hurricane coming on in today. Yeah, there could be a lot more suffering coming up. Hurricane Earl is now prompting evacuations. Evacuations have begun in areas of the U.S. East Coast, likely to be hit by Irma. The hurricane strengthened to a Category 4 storm, again generating sustained winds of 135 miles an hour. One island in North Carolina's Outer Banks is being evacuated right now, and visitors are being asked to leave another. We continue talking about the struggle for communities in New Orleans and Louisiana to fight back from Katrina 5 years ago. And one of those battles that we have been invited to go along with and to see what we can do to support is the battle to save Wesley United Church. This is an important cultural center, an African-American landmark functioning institution that the people of New Orleans need. Good friends, Socorro Kone has been on this, fighting this battle, the good fight, for a long time. Socorro, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis. It's good to be back, and really feels good to addressing your listeners in the area that I consider my second home, Oakland, Berkeley. Having lived out there for 8 years. So, you know, this is a special welcome home for me via the airwaves, and I thank you for the invitation.
Well, it is our pleasure, our honor. Before we jump into the saving of Wesley United Church, just give us a sort of a thumbnail sketch of what's been going through your mind 5 years after Katrina, BP disaster, and another hurricane on the way.
Oh, my goodness. just when you think you're going to catch your breath, here comes another catastrophe. The Katrina situation hasn't been totally resolved. We still have got about 45% of the population, the city, have not been rebuilt. In excess of 200,000 evacuees that want to come home, that have not been able to come home for various obstacles and factors that's confronting them, the BP situation, and then, of course, Earl. It's hard to really get your teeth into it, you know. The only thing the best way I can answer that question is just to stay focused in spite of the crisis, each one of them coming right after the other, just to stay focused in terms of what we're doing in terms of providing for our citizens, the New Orleans original population being a factor in terms of significant and positive factor in terms of aiding them to return. But then, you know, we got to help them to stay as well, because the cost of living has gone up 2.5 times it was before Katrina. The way I'm my own little niche of that whole endeavor is the effort to save 173-year-old institution that has been an integral part of the struggle for human rights in New Orleans for all of those years, the Wesley United Methodist Church, which we hope to save, restore, and transform into a multi-purpose center that's going to cater to the needs of New Orleans in general and the central city area population in particular, and the skills training and artistic enlightening endeavors. And that's the nutshell version.
All right. Well, that's great. Let's see if we can expand it out a little bit. Talk a little bit about the history of the church and its significance over many years.
Well, the church was originally built by slaves, and they did it voluntarily in exchange for the opportunity to worship there. The Methodist Church, the Methodist denomination of Christianity, is only one or two denomination of Christianity that opposed slavery from its inception in the United States. The other were the Quakers, and we are much more familiar with the Quakers because of their participation in the Underground Railroad. As a matter of fact, interesting enough, Wesley is named after John Wesley, the primary co-founder of Methodism, who was a passionate abolitionist out of England. He was a disillusioned Anglican priest who thought that the Church of England, which is also known as the Anglican Church, was too cozy with the government. And he believed in the separation of church and state and helped to form a Methodism in that endeavor. And his writings, if one were to Google John Wesley, you'll find the vast majority of his writings from the time he started writing pamphlets and books in the 1730s up until his death in 1793. Most of his writings is about the slave institution and how he considered it immoral and advocated the destruction of the slave institution. So Wesley was an intricate part of the struggle against slavery. Once the facility was completed, the Methodists did keep their word, and Wesley United opened to, interesting enough, in the heart of the Deep South during slavery to an integrated congregation of African slaves, whites, and free people of color. Now, the free people of color, interesting enough, the way they were freed was either through one or two processes. Either they had purchased their freedom or they escaped. And New Orleans at the time was almost totally surrounded by swampland. So it afforded escaped slaves a haven, if you will, living out in the swampland with their natural allies, which were the indigenous population, the Native American population that had been disenfranchised by the colonialists, the settlers. And so they had a natural ally, or even intermarrying. So they would come into the city just mixed in, because the population at that time was three-fourths black. So for every three person you saw out of four was a black person, so it was easier to integrate. And the authorities could only stop so many people and ask for their papers. If you were legitimately freed to purchase, then you had a stamp on your identification. If you could not produce that stamp, you would be arrested and presumed that you were an escaped slave. So that's the origins of Wesley, and during the ensuing years, it was a primary facility for organizing and fighting the slave institution up until 1865, after the Civil War, when the facility, after requests from its majority black congregation, received the opportunity to actually run and manage the facility all the way until 2005 with Hurricane Katrina. And in the years following, Wesley was a primary facility for fighting the Jim Crow racism law, the legal racism law that had implemented, the Jim Crow laws, legal segregation, legal discrimination, the lynchings. It was a hotbed of activism against these human rights violation, all the way into the 20th century, where it became a primary facility for organization of doing the civil rights movement. Some of the luminaries that had spoken there, including Mary Todd Lincoln in 1865. She read the Emancipation Proclamation. Mary Todd Lincoln, being the widow of Abraham Lincoln, read the Emancipation Proclamation for the first time ever in the Southern region, what formerly was the Confederate States, right at the Wesley United Methodist Church from the pulpit of Wesley United. The Honorable Marcus Garvey spoke there in 1920, the founder of the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Leagues United. To this very day, the organizer of the largest international and underlying international black movement for human rights and enfranchisement. Mary McLeod Bethune, the educator and civil rights leader, predating the modern civil rights era. She was a civil rights leader in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. She spoke there. Cecil B. DeMille, the filmmaker of epic film of the 1930s and 40s and 50s, there he is. Spoke there as well. Wesley's reputation preceded itself, and anybody and everybody who came to New Orleans of a prestige wanted the opportunity to speak at that particular institution. Our efforts, current contemporary efforts, is to transform it into a multi-purpose center. Well, Central City, where Wesley is located, is the highest unemployment area of all of New Orleans. It is the highest crime area in all of New Orleans. One out of every two murders that happens in New Orleans happens in Central City, in spite of the fact that Central City had gave birth to search culture that became eventually internationally renowned, such as the Black Mardi Gras Indian culture, the Second Line, the Black Brass Bands. It's also the birthplace of Central City, that is, of Louis Armstrong, Professor Longhair, the Marcellus family, Wynton being the most famous god, and the list goes on and on and on. In spite of that illustrious history, it has fallen on hard times post-Katrina, and our young people have involved themselves in criminal activities, partially due to the fact that two-thirds of the schools, the public schools, have not, to this very day, 5 years after Katrina, have not reopened. So a lot of the criminality is being caused by young people 18 years and under because they don't see any options. They're not being educated. They don't have any skills. They have very little to no recreational facilities. And Wesley hopes to remedy, at least put a dent in that reality.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. What a history you are telling us about Socorro. And this is an endangered species. This church is continuing to be crucial in the community. It's a fight to keep it alive. We're out of time at this moment, but tell people more about how they can learn more about the church, about your battle. Maybe Absolutely. They want to come visit. They want to meet sure. you, see this extraordinary piece of history, a living history that you want to keep as an important part of the community.
Absolutely. We could ill afford to lose our institution. As I'm speaking to you about Wesley United, we're trying to save Charity Hospital, which is over 100 years in existence. Methodist Hospital, I mentioned two-thirds of the public schools have not reopened. Two-thirds of the health facilities have not reopened as well. And that's a whole other story. But for further information about what we're doing, I want to encourage your listeners to go to our website, www.savewesleyunited.org. SaveWesleyUnited.org, and Wesley is spelled WESLEY. For those who do not have access to computer, please do give us a call, area code 504-861-5017. Again, 504-861-5017, and we want to encourage you to find out more and to support us in whatever way that you can.
Socorro Kone, working to save Wesley United Church, an extraordinary piece of history. Amazing to hear about it. And we want to continue to hear about the progress. And hopefully one day we'll be able to come down and do a special broadcast from your live international broadcast studios at the church.
We would love that. Yes, indeed. To do a remote from New Orleans, Wesley United, and the broadcast to the world, essentially.
Here we go. Thank you so much, Socorro.
All right. You all take care now, and it's good being with you.
Peace. All right. Our honor, our pleasure. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is People's Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine.
And that'll do it for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and can be heard again at flashpoints.net. The executive producer of Flashpoints is Dennis Bernstein. Technical director, Eric Klein. Roving producer is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Special projects and online producer, Jesse Strauss. Regular contributors include Catherine Austin Fitz for Community Business, John Gibler in Mexico, Kevin Pina on Haiti, and Friday co-hosts Francisco Herrera and Rene Saucedo. JR and The Block Report contribute to the program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for the archives of the show, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/flashpointsnews. Thanks for listening.